This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. Now, here's your host, Wayne Zell.
Good morning and welcome to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, your host of this fast-paced half hour of special topics and special guests designed to help you realize your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by the law firm of Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman, located in Reston, Virginia, serving the entire D.C. metro area and clients all across the country. If you'd like to know more about this diverse firm, visit us on the web at www.ofplaw.com. Also, I invite you to subscribe to my blog, blueprintforwealth.org, where you can see audios, hear audios, see videos, and read articles of interest in tax, estate planning, and business planning. And lastly, please read my column in the Washington Business Journal every month entitled Blueprint for Wealth, where I talk about tax, estate planning, and business planning topics. Today, we're going to talk about something a little bit unusual, but you may have come across it in your individual realm, or you may have come across it in your business realm, but it's something known as a service level agreement. A service level agreement, or commonly referred to as an SLA, is part of a service contract where the service level is formally defined. In practice, the term SLA sometimes refers to a contracted delivery time of the service or performance of a service. For an example, internet service providers like Verizon or AOL will commonly include service level agreements within the terms of their contracts with customers to define the level of uptime or the level of service that's being sold in plain language terms. In this case, the SLA typically has a technical definition in terms of the time between failures, the mean time, the average time between failures, or the average time to repair, or the average time to recover if there was a disaster. Various data rates, throughput, jitter, similar measurable details that are commonly referred to in these contracts. Many, you may understand it or you may not. If you're in business, though, this becomes really important. A service level agreement is negotiated between two parties. One is the customer and the other is the service provider. It can be a legally binding formal contract or an informal arrangement. Contracts between the service provider and other third parties are often incorrectly referred to as SLAs, service level agreements, because the level of service has been set by the customer. There can be no agreement between third parties. These agreements are simply a contract. Operational level agreements, OLAs, however, may be used by internal groups to support SLAs. Let me give you an example. Let's say you're in a company and you've got an IT department that is servicing the entire company, 100 or 200 or 1,000 employees. There may be agreements by the internal IT department as to how fast they can react to a particular complaint. You actually may have to send some kind of email to initiate your complaint or your concern to a help desk. Then the help desk is required to respond to you within a certain period of time. And then after they respond to you, the question is how quickly can they remedy the problem? All of these things are encompassed in an SLA. The SLA records a common understanding about services and priorities and responsibilities and guarantees and even warranties. Each area of service scope should have the level of service defined. The SLA may specify the levels of availability, of serviceability, of performance, operation, or other attributes of the service, such as billing. The level of service also can be specified as a target rate or a minimum level of achievement that they have to achieve, or a minimum level or maximum level of downtime that you're allowed to achieve, depending on what is being provided. This allows the customer to be informed about what to expect, the minimum, while providing a measurable average target value that shows the level of performance that is expected of the service provider. In some contracts, penalties may be agreed upon in the case of non-compliance with the level of service that was agreed to in the SLA. But with internal customers and internal providers, there may not be any kind of penalty that would be imposed or even enforceable, like your own IT department. Are you going to penalize them? Well, you may rate them or evaluate them at the end of the year, and if they don't perform up to the standards that they laid out for you, then that would be an indication that they're not performing up to the standard and that they may not be entitled to bonuses or they may not be entitled to profit sharing, something along those lines. Penalties could be agreed upon in advance, but it's also to note that the agreement relates to the services that you, the customer, receive and not how the service provider delivers the service. As long as they provide the service that was contracted to within the time frame or within the measurement that was agreed upon, then they've met their obligation. SLAs also commonly include segments to address, a definition of what services are being provided, how to measure their performance measurement, how to measure whether a problem in fact exists and how to deal with it. What the customer's duties and warranties are under these agreements are important. And then if in the case of a disaster, like power outage, or if there is a loss of data or something along those lines, what the disaster recovery plan is for a particular customer. And then, of course, last but not least, under what circumstances can the agreement be terminated? In order to ensure that SLAs are consistently met, these agreements often are designed with specific lines of demarcation, and the parties involved are required to meet regularly to create an open communication forum. Contract enforcement, whether it's a reward for exceptional performance or penalties for failing to perform, should be rigidly enforced. But most SLAs leave room for annual revisitation between the parties so that it's possible to make changes based on new information that's provided. If I'm the service provider, I'm going to try to stay away from very rigorous penalties. Or if penalties are going to be imposed, I want to make sure that I have enough room that I can operate within so that any technical glitch or technical fault is not viewed as a breach of my service level guarantee and therefore is going to be subjecting me to penalties. If I'm the customer and I need to be up 99.99% of the time without exception, then I want rigorous enforcement and rigorous penalties. SLAs have been used since the late 1980s by telecom operators as part of their contracts with corporate customers. This practice has spread such that it is now common for a customer to engage a service provider by including an SLA in a wide range of service contracts in practically all industries and all markets. Internal departments like IT departments or HR, human resources departments, or even real estate divisions of companies in large organizations have adopted the idea of using service level agreements with their internal customers, with the rest of the company, the users who are in other departments within the same organization. A benefit of this is that it enables the quality of service to be actually benchmarked with agreed to across multiple locations standards that are hopefully enforced or used to evaluate the performance of those providing the services. It can also be used to market test and provide a value comparison between an in-house department who is providing it in a captive environment, if you will, and an outsourced external service provider. Service level agreements are by their nature output-based. The result of the service as received by the customer is the subject of the agreement. The service provider can demonstrate their value by organizing themselves with ingenuity, with capability, and with knowledge to deliver the service required, perhaps in a very innovative way. Organizations also can specify the way the service is to be delivered through a specification, and using subordinate objectives other than those related to the level of the service. This type of agreement is also known as an input SLA, and it's becoming obsolete as organizations become more demanding and shift the way in which they deliver the services. As long as they're providing the service, the method of delivering the service may not be as important. SLAs are defined at differing levels. There's the customer-based SLA, which is an agreement with an individual customer group. It covers all the services that they may use. For example, an SLA between an IT service provider, information technology company, and the finance department of a large organization for the services that they're using, such as an accounting system or a finance system or payroll or billing or procurement or purchasing, would be an example of a customer-based SLA agreement that where you want to make sure that your accounting system, your payroll system is up 100% of the time and that there would be specific parameters within which the service provider has to perform. You also have service-based SLAs, which is an agreement for all customers who are using the same service. A common example would be an email system for the entire organization or for all users. There are chances of difficulties arising in this type of situation where one person might be using high-speed delivery, high-speed internet, and another person may still be using dial-up. The expectations of the service and the speed at which things are being provided may be very different depending on the customer and what delivery methodology they're choosing to use with the service provider. There's also something known as a multi-level SLA. It's split into different levels, each addressing different sets of customers for the same services. This has become more prevalent where cloud computing has become the norm rather than something that's new and different. If you'd like to know more about SLAs or you need help in crafting an SLA for your business, give us a call at 703-218-2100. I'm Wayne Zell, and you're listening to Blueprint for Wealth.
You're listening to Blueprint for Wealth with Wayne Zell. Learn how to better prepare for your future when Blueprint for Wealth returns in just a few moments.
A Legal Minute with Wayne Zell.
You may have a dilemma when you start up your business. How can you obtain capital you need to start? In many cases, you're not able to convince a bank or a lender to lend you money for an untested business idea. You may approach investors for capital, but they may show little interest or offer outrageous terms. You can use your own money to finance your ideas, but for those with limited savings, it can be a problem. So, you may bankroll the business with credit cards. Obviously, this method of financing comes with great risk. Many credit cards offer less favorable terms than traditional bank loans, and credit card companies can demand double-digit interest rates. Because of the financial risks associated with credit cards, you may want to exhaust all other avenues for financing, including your friends, family, or small business loans, before resorting to credit cards to finance your business. If you'd like to know more about financing your business, call us at 703-218-2100 for more information.
Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. If you have questions for Wayne, you can email him at radio@ofplaw.com or call him 703-218-2100. Now back to your host, Wayne Zell.
Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, and with me today is my special guest and partner, Dave Zangrilli. Welcome, Dave.
Thanks, Wayne. Thanks for having me.
Dave's calling in today. He is a principal in our firm's Family Law and Domestic Relations Practice Group and represents clients in courts throughout Virginia, including Northern Virginia counties of Arlington, Fairfax, Loudoun, Prince William, the city of Alexandria, and you name it, all over the place. And he's been a family law attorney for almost 10 years. He's been on the show before, and he's talked to us about a variety of different issues, including prenuptial agreements. Today, Dave, what are we talking about? What's our topic du jour?
Wayne, today we're going to talk about taxes and how taxes need to be considered when folks are getting a divorce and when they're drafting their property settlement agreements.
It's near and dear to my heart. I love taxes. And what's the first bit of advice that you always give to your clients when you're talking to them?
Yeah, the first bit of advice we always give and that I always give is to make sure you consult with either a CPA or a tax lawyer like yourself, because most divorce attorneys are not CPAs. And although we certainly you know, the good ones know enough about taxes, and we've learned a lot about taxes over the years. We're not CPAs, and to make clients feel really safe and secure, we always advise them to speak with either a CPA or a tax lawyer.
That's true, and I think there's you start with probably one of the most important points that everyone needs to know about, and that is about alimony. Tell us about alimony.
Yeah, that's probably the most well-known issue in terms of taxes in a divorce. When a payor, oftentimes, but not always, oftentimes the husband historically, pays alimony that is deductible to the payor on his or her taxes. And the recipient of the alimony has to include that income, that alimony as income on their taxes.
You know, that's an interesting concept. Every month there may be an alimony payment, right?
Correct.
And so one of the things that people forget about is that when they are receiving these alimony payments, that they not only have to report it on their income tax, but that it also is subject to estimated tax, is it not?
That's correct. They're supposed to really pay those quarterly, although I...
That's right. That's
if I had a dollar for every time one of my clients has done that, I'd probably have $1.
No.
Because most people just don't do that. And it can be a shock to the system when that individual goes to file his or her taxes at the end of the year, and then all of a sudden I have to include all that alimony as income that they haven't paid taxes on. So when they may have thought they were going to receive a refund, now all of a sudden they have a tax liability to the IRS.
Now, what's so unique about alimony? I know that there are specific rules under the Internal Revenue Code in order for it to be treated as alimony.
Yeah, the biggest rule really, and there's a few of them, but probably the most important is that the alimony has to be paid pursuant to either a court order or a written agreement, a contract, you know, a property settlement agreement. If you just pay voluntarily, you know, if you have a handshake deal with your spouse that I'll start paying you alimony and you pay a bunch of money each month for a period of time, and then you go to deduct that on your taxes as the payor, the IRS isn't going to let you do that. You have to actually have a provision in a court order or an agreement saying that this is alimony and this will be tax deductible to me, the payor, and tax includable, you know, to the recipient.
So what about child support? Is it treated the same or differently?
Child support is not treated the same. It's different. Child support is not taxable.
And when you're negotiating a settlement, I mean, what are some of the important things that people are looking at when they're negotiating the settlement here?
Yeah, one of the biggest issues that I think most people, at least coming into the process, haven't thought about is the tax effect of the spousal support, of the alimony. Because oftentimes, you know, in these divorce cases here in Virginia, most clients, most lawyers, we all use the same sheets. We have these clients fill out what we call income and expense statements, which are really just it's just a monthly budget.
Right.
And at the bottom, you know, it's an Excel spreadsheet, and it tells you, here's how much money I need each month to pay all of my bills. So, you know, let's say it says $5,000. So the client says, I need at least $5,000 in spousal support.
Right.
Well, the part they don't consider is they're going to have to pay taxes on that at the end of the year. So really, you know, depending on which tax bracket they're in, they may need $5,500 or $6,000 in support to actually meet their monthly expenses.
Okay.
And it's the same thing for the payor. It can actually be a benefit. You know, oftentimes the payor will get angry when they see the large number that their spouse is requesting. You know, I can't believe that she wants me to pay $8,000 a month in spousal support. Well, what they don't think about is the net effect, that really they're paying, you know, $6,500 or whatever the figure is based upon their particular tax bracket.
That's right. And I think that's a really important thing to remind people of. If you're going to treat it as alimony, it's taxable, unlike when you're married, you know, payments to a spouse are non-deductible and not taxed as income.
That's exactly right.
Now, let's talk about retirement plans. What's so unique about retirement plans, IRAs, pensions, profit-sharing plans?
Yeah, IRAs and retirements and all defined contribution plans are not – it's not a taxable event when such a retirement plan is divided during a divorce process.
Okay.
So if husband has a 401k with $100,000 in it and the parties agree that wife will get, you know, half of that, it's a non-taxable event pursuant to a divorce. What happens is essentially the money goes over to the wife and she has her own individual 401k account. And then, of course, the only time it would be taxable is if, you know, either spouse takes an actual distribution out of that retirement account.
Right. And then it becomes taxable as ordinary income. And, you know, there's all kinds of issues in terms of the tax rate as compared to other types of income.
Right.
What I know that there's something called a quadro that people refer to in these environments. So tell us a little bit about that real quick.
Sure. A quadro is it's an abbreviation, QDRO, which stands for Qualified Domestic Relations Order. Under the federal code, you know, it's governed by ERISA. A lot of these plans are governed by the federal statute ERISA. And when you divide up a 401k, or 403Bs or similar retirement vehicles, you need to have the quadro. It's just a court order entered by the court, which divides up the retirement. And these can kind of be a pain in the neck for lawyers to draft, and it can be quite a process. When you deal with IRAs, those are not generally subject to ERISA, so you don't need to get into that hassle of drafting a quadro. It's much easier to divide. But oftentimes people are really angered over how long it takes to have a quadro entered by the court and sent to the plan administrator to actually have the 401ks divided up between the spouses.
That's interesting. So a very important point to note that Dave just brought up, a qualified domestic relations order is required for ERISA-covered plans like profit-sharing plans, 401ks. But it's not required for individual retirement account splitting, even though the splitting is not going to be taxed.
Correct.
Okay,
correct.
Good. Now, we talked about splitting, you know, retirement plans. What about all other assets?
The nice thing about divorce, maybe one of the only, you know, positive things about the divorce process is that whenever assets are divided, it's a non-taxable event. The simple fact of the divorce and the splitting up of assets does not trigger any taxes. So if you receive stock, for example, from your spouse, you know, you have the same tax basis as he or she did. You know, so the parties don't pay taxes on any assets they receive pursuant to a divorce separation, pursuant to a divorce agreement, I should say.
I wonder if the ease with which the Internal Revenue Code allows for a divorce to occur has influenced the rate of divorce over the years. I just sort of thought of that.
I'm just guessing that that's probably not one of the primary factors.
One of the intended consequences of these provisions.
Right.
So what happens at the end of the year when it's time to file taxes? Let's say the divorce went through, you know, on October the 31st and it was finalized. How do you file taxes then?
Yeah, good question. The way the IRS works it is that your tax status, whether you file married, head of household, married, filing separately, what have you, is determined as of December 31 of that taxable year. So, for example, let's talk about 2012. If spouses are divorced in 2012, mm-hmm. they have to file a single because that's what their tax status is.
Okay.
The bigger issue more often is that, you know, the parties have separated and maybe they even have a property settlement agreement in place, but, you know, January 1 rolls around and they're still married. The question is, how are they going to file taxes? And the best practice is certainly to have that issue negotiated and resolved in the property settlement agreement so that each party knows, you know, if alimony was paid, how is it going to be claimed? Who's going to claim the child? You know, if there's deductions relating to your house, the mortgage interest deduction and the real estate tax deduction, who are going to claim those? So, you know, a good piece of advice is to make sure you negotiate that and have it included in the property settlement agreement.
That is a good piece of advice. Thanks for that. Now, what about, you know, on the tax returns, we all try to claim our children as dependents to the extent that we have children that we're supporting. How does that work?
Yeah, it's an issue that often is a bit of a hot button issue that it seems to be much ado about nothing because mm-hmm. you know if you've ever done your own taxes you know that claiming a child doesn't save you a whole heck of a lot of money. You know, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $800 to $1,200 ish. So oftentimes parties end up, you know, divorcing spouses spend more money fighting over that than it's worth. It can obviously be valuable if you're going to claim, you know, if you're contributing $5,000 to a flexible spending dependent care account.
Dependent care spending account, right.
Exactly, so that you can then, you know, not include that $5,000 in your income so you don't have to pay taxes on that.
Right.
But what happens more often than not is, you know, under federal law, if the custodial parent, the quote-unquote custodial parent, gets to claim the child on his or her taxes.
Right.
But the property settlement agreement can change that. So often it is negotiated, and usually what happens is the parties simply end up alternating claiming the child. You know, I claim the child this year, you claim the child next year.
Yeah, because you can't really split the dependency exemption, can you?
Correct. And that's, you know, that's the most likely outcome if you went before a judge. They usually just simply alternate claiming the child.
Okay. Now, another big ticket item or seemingly big ticket item in divorce is the house. You know, how do we claim mortgage deductions, taxes? What happens when we sell it? You know, how does that work?
Right. And there's often it's exacerbated by the fact there's often a lengthy period of time where, you know, one spouse has moved out and the other spouse and oftentimes the children are still living in the house. And there's a lengthy period of time where the parties are negotiating, trying to get a property settlement agreement in place. So you could have, you know, certainly more than a year where we're dealing with this issue. So it certainly is something that needs to be negotiated into the property settlement agreement.
And the marketplace dictates a lot about what happens with the house, too, because the market is not just such that you can just turn around and sell a house in 30 days, typically.
Exactly. So even if both parties are on board and really want to sell the house, you're absolutely right. It could take a significant period of time. So what often happens is you have the parties reach some kind of agreement as to when the house will be sold and who will pay the mortgage, you know, during that time. And, you know, the easiest example is when the parties agree that they'll each pay the mortgage 50-50, in which case then usually what happens is each party gets to claim 50% of the mortgage interest deductions and 50% of the real estate deductions on his or her taxes.
Okay.
Sometimes you have a situation where it's just one party paying the mortgage.
Right.
And usually what's agreed is that that person then gets to claim all of those deductions on his or her taxes.
Now, let's say one of the spouses remains in the house. Is that considered some kind of imputed rent, or because they're still married, it's not considered that? Or even if there's a divorce order or divorce decree that allows one of the spouses to remain in the house, is that taxable to the one who's remaining in the house?
No. Are you asking the use of the house?
The use of the house.
No, the way it normally happens is it's not quite a tax issue. It's more of a property issue.
Right.
And the spouse who's been living in the house, you know, if they're paying the mortgage, then they're asking for usually more alimony, or they're asking the other spouse to contribute to the mortgage.
Right.
And if let's assume the person living in the house is the one paying the mortgage, when the parties end up dividing the property, the party who's been living there and paying the mortgage wants credit for the principal that they've paid down on the mortgage during the process. So that's
Absolutely.
Usually where it shakes out.
That's another good twist of the facts. Now, there's also the unusual circumstance where you actually sell the house. You get an exclusion for $250,000 if you're married filing jointly. If you're separate, you only get $250,000. You get $500 if you're married filing jointly. You only get $250 if you're single or married filing separately.
Correct.
So there are some rules on that. Can you allocate that? How that's going to be handled in the property settlement agreement?
You can. I mean, you know, at least in the Northern Virginia real estate market, we haven't had to worry about that too
right,
much in the
right.
last 5 years, because very few folks have.
Huh.
You know, more than $250,000 of equity in their house, or more than $250,000 of gain, certainly.
Good point.
So oftentimes we will include language in the PSA which governs that issue. You know, it says if there's capital gains that each party, you know, claims 50%, or each party gets, you know, X percent of the exclusion, but 99 out of 100 times it's a provision that doesn't do much because there are no capital gains, at least in this real estate market. Now, hopefully that will change at some point in the near future. But the general rule is, and there's a few parts of this rule, but the general rule is that, as you mentioned, a single person can exclude $250,000 of capital gain, and a married couple can exclude $500,000, as long as, to be able to qualify for the exclusion, the home needs to have been your principal place of residence for at least two of the last 5 years.
Are legal fees deductible?
Legal fees can be deductible. It's a question that I don't get asked very often. I usually only get asked that when the party has a CPA or a tax attorney that they're working with. And it's really only the fees that relate to the collection of spousal support.
Right.
So oftentimes clients ask me to send me their bill with the line entries, you know, the line items showing spousal support. And oftentimes that's difficult to do because, you know, so many things are interrelated, so it's hard to parse out on an attorney's bill which line items are for alimony, which are for a bunch of different things.
Right.
You know, so it can be difficult. Usually we turn that over to the CPAs and let them deal with it.
We're talking with Dave Zangrilli. Dave, if people want to get in touch with you to talk about family law issues, how do they reach you?
They can either call me directly at 703-218-2152 or shoot me an email at david.zangrilli@ofplaw.com.
Thanks for being a special guest on Blueprint for Wealth.
Thanks for having me, Wayne.
Thanks for listening, and join us next week for another special topic and special guest. Have a great week.
You've been listening to Wayne Zell and Blueprint for Wealth. Wayne will be back next Saturday morning at 10 with your Blueprint for Wealth right here on 1500 AM Federal News Radio.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now.
Federal News Radio in a web